Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. The killings of African Americans, such as George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, have sparked protests around the country and the world calling for racial justice. On the University of New Mexico campus, African American Student Services reached out to students to see what they needed to talk through and process these events. The result was a series of conversations with different professors, one of whom will be on the show today. Most of the videos are available on Instagram under the handle @UNMAfro. Brandi Stone is AASS Director and Special Advisor to UNM President Garnet S. Stokes on African American Affairs. The series was called Shaking the Room.
Instead of saying like the elephant in the room, they'll say it's a little too quiet in here. We need to shake up the room and have this discussion or that discussion.
And why was that so necessary to the kind of conversations you had?
Well, because I think anti-blackness is the elephant in the room, or the thing that we need to shake up. Because I think for so many people, we largely still believe that this is a colorblind society and we're post-racial.
Is it something that you will continue to do?
Yes. Our students loved that platform and they loved unpacking that conversation. We're already planning for an August session. In October, we usually host a Southwest Regional Black Student Leadership Conference. And so we are looking to shift that into a full virtual model. And we partner with Eastern New Mexico, New Mexico State, New Mexico Highlands. So we know that we will have some engaging dialogue in October, but definitely before then, because this year, what's so interesting about this school year is that we have COVID and we have Black Lives Matter and we have an election year. So it's really important and critical that we have these discussions early.
Finney Coleman was one of the speakers in the Shaking the Room series. He's Associate Professor of American Literary Studies in the Department of English and Literature, and he's the current Faculty Senate President. The Black Lives Matter movement was founded by three women in 2013 following the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who fatally shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Florida when the teenager was walking home from a convenience store. But Coleman says the energy behind the Black Lives Matter movement began much earlier, with the civil rights movement and the outrage over the beating of Rodney King by Los Angeles police, who were acquitted. Even though this earlier state violence was filmed, the images now spread far more widely by the internet.
And that's what's different in this moment, is the internet and social media have made these images of violence ubiquitous. You can't avoid them. You can't pretend that they aren't there. And that's always been a challenge in American society, dealing with whether it's racial issues or whether it's gender inequities, whether it's homophobia. The dominant culture, mainstream white America, has been able to dissemble and pretend that it had no idea that these things were happening.
And it's interesting that the women who started Black Lives Matter, their mission statement was quite beautiful. It's eradicate white supremacy and build local power to intervene in violence inflicted on Black communities by the state and vigilantes by combating and countering acts of violence, creating space for Black imagination and innovation, and centering Black joy. We are winning immediate improvements in our lives. Including joy in that statement is really profound.
Part of being free is being able to go into a park, to enjoy yourself in public space without fear of harm. Tamir Rice goes into a park, he's playing with a toy gun, and police arrive, and in less than a minute, this child is dead. And so it is actually in hip hop culture that we see this reclaiming of public space. And it's that reclaiming of public space that allows people to express their identities more fully, more openly. And so breakdancing and b-boy culture, graffiti, all of those were expressions of the art in public spaces. And so when the town square is dominated by one voice, one group of people, you can expect that true freedom comes when all people are able to enter that space. Some people have to enter the space surreptitiously. Some have to enter it through ways and mechanisms that, you know, the dominant culture is not going to appreciate or like. Sometimes it means marching down the center of the street with a sign that says, "This is what I've been trying to tell you, but you have refused to listen."
You write that one of the misconceptions people in the dominant culture have about Black Lives Matter is that it's asking us for something.
Yeah, it's a strange conceit and arrogance. It's always been unfounded. It's really touching on a response to not just Black Lives Matter, but the Civil Rights Movement and other moments when the dominant culture has been challenged. Black people, lesbian, gay, bi, transgendered, have never wanted to be given something. They've wanted to have the opportunity to express the blessings of liberty that all of us get as part of our inalienable rights. It is asking people who are in power, who are in positions of authority, to stop taking those inalienable rights away from us. The rights and privileges that accrue to me as being an American citizen, as being a human being, are granted outside of the power of any particular group in society. They come to me because I'm a human being. They come to me because I'm part of a community, because I'm part of a society. So folk who would rather reserve the rights and privileges, the American dream for themselves, have used law, they've used custom, they've used violence to keep people who are not them from having access to what should rightly accrue to all of us. In one sense, all of these civil rights movements and equal rights movements have simply been to get one group of people to allow all people to enjoy this American dream that we've talked about unfettered, to simply live out the words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Nothing more than that.
We've seen a number of deaths of Black people this year by police or vigilantes. Why do you think George Floyd's killing in particular sparked such an outpouring of outrage, not just here, but around the world?
Well, I think it was a perfect storm. No reasonable person could look at what happened and argue that this person deserved somehow what happened to him. A person who pled for his life for 8 minutes, begging just not to die. And this man, with his knee on this person's throat, with his hands in his pockets, what it suggested was just how cavalier that authority figure was in the moment that he took this person's life, and that he remained in that cavalier position minutes after this man lost consciousness and his life, that it wasn't enough just to execute him in the street, but to do what happened in lynchings, and that is to display the body, to display that image of dominance so that it would be unmistakable to other people who might challenge that dominance. And again, couple that with the pent-up energy born of the disfranchisement of people during this COVID epidemic, and how people who were the first to be fired typically are people of color, and the last to be hired back, typically people of color, that those people in this moment saw, as they'd seen for months and years and decades before, the attitude of the dominant culture in this country toward them was very cavalier. And so this energy has always been there, just beneath the surface. COVID rips through that surface. It brings to the fore problems that might have otherwise been glossed over. And I think also this generation of our youth, because of the kind of anonymity that social media provides for them, even kids who are in the dominant culture are able to have avatars that go out into the world who are not them racially. They get to see the world from the perspective of that avatar that is deracinated, that doesn't have race. And so white people in ways, especially youth, are participating in an economy where what you say and what you do is more important than your skin color. I think for white youth in America, social media is providing a platform for them to understand race and difference in ways that previous generations never just didn't have access to. That doesn't mean that that generation is going to by default be any more or less racist or a white supremacist. But what it means is that they have access to a different type of truth than generations of white people have had in the past. And what they're doing with that energy, you can see in these protests. Many, many of the people who are protesting are not just black kids or brown kids It's white kids out there in the midst of this as well. And so there's a consciousness being evolved in this generation. And of course, we need to reach a tipping point in that generation, right? Where voting for Barack Obama won't be enough. Where donating to a local charity that benefits lesbian victims of domestic violence, that won't be enough. That will move beyond the transactional way that most of our generations have dealt with race and racism and white supremacy and white fragility to a more sophisticated, nuanced understanding of what those things mean. Now, mind you, that generation is coming of age. It's up to people like you and me to provide as much education and information as we can to that generation and then get the hell out of the way. We can't make the same mistakes that previous generations made and stifling and telling the generations what they should and should not do, how they should and should not feel. No, we're in a different moment. And it's not just Black kids, it's white kids, it's all kids across this country that this COVID is transforming in ways that might turn out to be blessings in disguise.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought about that intersection of COVID and state violence against people of color and how those are coming together to form this new consciousness. Why do you think COVID is so key to that?
I think because COVID is indiscriminate. It has pointed up for this generation in ways that they may not have seen their own mortality. Almost all of us are touched by this thing. It points out the fragility of humanity, not just the fragility of this group that's been oppressed or this group that's been dominant. It says that all of us as human beings have to take our collective humanity into consideration. I think that's what is driving, that's the dark energy, if you will, and dark not in the sense of bad, but that energy that has a propulsive power that you can't see, that kind of expansion in the universe, if you will.
How do you think this mirrors previous movements for racial justice?
You know, every movement is different and every movement's the same. The aims are the same, trying to get us to a place where we as human beings treat each other with dignity and respect. As a species, we've just never been able to do that. It's different in that the historical factors and agents at play are different. It's different in that the way that we are communicating it and communicating about it are different. I think that women, people of color, the LGBTQ community has a voice in this movement that hasn't been paralleled in the past. During the civil rights movement, Black men, their voices were privileged within the Black community. So Ella Jo Baker was out, she was out doing incredible work, but we didn't hear a lot about that. Fannie Lou Hamer was doing a great deal of work, but we tended to focus on King and Malcolm. Constance Baker Motley was behind the scenes doing incredible work, but we focused on people like Thurgood Marshall instead of her. So those voices have always been there, but they have come to the forefront, especially in this movement where three Black women are the founding energies for this particular wave in the movement. And three women from very different social, political, sexual orientation, lifestyle backgrounds. These are three very different Black women who came together to share their voice in a very public way, and it caught on. That's something that, again, has been muted in these liberation movements in the past. So I think for the first time, we're approaching parity in those who are allowed to speak. And if we can make a criticism of the civil rights movement, the gender politics of it were palpable. You know, we look at Elaine Brown being the first woman to lead a civil rights organization, and how vicious the Federal Bureau of Investigations was when she came to lead that organization and did everything in its power to discredit her, to discredit people like Angela Davis, Black women who rose up as leaders. They have been viciously attacked. But in this case, because of the diffuse nature of the leadership in Black Lives Matter, you can't go out and assassinate the leader and hope that the movement is going to stop. This one is beyond the control of the dominant society. And I think that's what makes it so nettlesome to certain politicians.
It's interesting you bring that up. There was recently a story on NPR about the creation of the hashtag Say Her Name, with the idea that we need to give more attention to other cases like Breonna Taylor and other women who've died of police violence or vigilante violence that maybe they haven't received.
And I think also how Black women in the arts have also been kind of marginalized. And I think people should pay attention to Janelle Monáe, because she really is artistically, has situated herself as the voice of that generation of performers, and how Afrofuturism is rising as a very interesting way of reimagining history, but more important, reimagining what our possibilities are in the future. I think there's a remarkable gender bias against her and what she's trying to accomplish. You know, we can look at all of the roles that Will Smith has had in action movies and Afrofuturist movies. I kind of halfway expected him to show up in Black Panther. Regina King plays Sister Night in Watchmen, and it's a performance for the ages.
Yeah.
I mean, her performance is outstanding in that role, and very little attention is given to her. I think that needs to change. We just because we've, you know, tapped into a different strata in our social consciousness in America doesn't mean that we don't have a long way to go.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with Associate Professor of American Literary Studies and Faculty Senate President Finney Coleman about the current movement for racial justice.
You teach among your courses Afrofuturism. You have a course in the fall on that, and we talk about fantasy or sci-fi kinds of things. Why is that so important to all of what we're talking about?
Well, think about the potential activist, a young man or woman of color who has something important to say, and they want to venture into the public square to say it. But the imagery that they've had from the past is that when you venture into that space with a message that the dominant culture doesn't want you to bring into that space, then the wages of that can be death. How many of our young people have not come forward because they've been afraid that they would wind up like Eric Garner or Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin or Breonna Taylor or Sandra Bland? I mean, how many of them have not spoken, have been muted? What Afrofuturism does is it says, what if we can produce an imagination of the past, an imagination of possibility, where it is absolutely safe for you to walk out into the public square? Imagine a future where you can have that voice, and that voice won't be muted because of the color of your skin, that you won't be shot and killed. And it's in that imaginary that you can then find the kind of courage that you need to find your voice to speak. The human brain doesn't distinguish between stereotype and justified belief when it's making a snap decision, your implicit biases. It does not, your brain doesn't know. It takes those things as fact when it's time to make a snap decision. So what Afrofuturism does is it provides material, it provides perspective that says, listen, you don't have to be afraid. The past cannot harm you in ways that you might have imagined that it could. We're going to break the shackles from that past. Slavery does not have to be a weight around your throat. Afrofuturism celebrates this remarkable survival story that in spite of slavery, in spite of gender inequity, we have a Janelle Monáe. In spite of all of those horrific things from the past, we have this remarkable future in front of us. And all that's left for us to do with the future is to imagine it into being. But if you're using the detritus of slavery, Jim Crow, all of the different things that Black people and brown people across this country have faced, if you can move beyond the shackles that has always provided, because your mind doesn't know when it's looking at the past, if it's looking at the truth or a stereotype of the truth. It simply looks at that past as being the past and then does its work. Afrofuturism moves us beyond that. And it is a powerful, powerful movement. And it's showing young people what their possibilities are, not in spite of the past exclusively, but because of and in spite of the past. Watching young people learn about their possibility, and that possibility not being grounded in the notion of failure or pain, is very powerful.
You brought up the Watchmen and Regina King's performance in that. It was on HBO, and it showed in detail the horror of the Tulsa massacre and apparently educated a lot of people about the existence of this in history, because I never learned about it in school. What I loved is that at some point it shows a museum in Tulsa that commemorates the massacre. You can go look up your DNA if you're a descendant. It has like holograms. Henry Louis Gates is there. And I was like, does that exist? I want to go there. Does that exist? And I was just crushed. I'm like, no, it doesn't. But maybe it could. That's one of the things I took away from like what you're saying. It's like, there's all these possibilities we could be doing right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think your example of the Tulsa Museum is an outstanding example. I believe that there are places that you can go in Tulsa and learn about the Tulsa Massacre, not museum space in the sense of, you know, what we see in the Lorraine Motel in Memphis or the National Museum in Washington, D.C., but there are those places there. But what you're pointing out is, to what degree will the new awareness about Tulsa lead us to do things that help us to rectify and heal? The victims of that have never healed. Rosewood Massacre never healed. I mean, we've been, all of these different massacres and, you know, acts of violence, we imagine don't move from one generation to the next, but we see in Tulsa that they do. And so that should tell us we need to go back to places like Rosewood, and we need to look at the communities there and look at what this legacy has produced. And understanding and acknowledging, you know, Tulsa, I think we have the possibility of moving beyond it. It takes that reconciliation to do so. And who knows, but one day we don't have that museum that Henry Louis Gates and other, that imaginary space where you can drop your acorn and figure out, you know, where you're from. I just thought that was a brilliant metaphor for them as well.
Many white people, those of us in the dominant culture, are asking right now, what do we need to do? I'm sure you've been asked that a lot. I'm sure people are tired of being asked that. But do you have an answer?
I do. It's maybe not the answer that most people are going to want to hear. The answer is listen the first time. Why do you have to be told again and again and again the same thing over and over and over again? There's nothing new that you're being told. There's nothing new that you're being seen. You may be seeing for the first time. And what you have needed to do has always been very clear, but there's always been reluctance to do it. It is to examine the system of privileges based on race that provide us with the notion of a dominant culture. Interrogate it. Understand and learn more about white fragility. Understand more about implicit bias. Go out and fix what you can fix in yourself as an individual. When we study implicit bias, we know that you can render those implicit biases explicit. So once you come to understand what they are, they become explicit biases. And now you can do things to stamp out behavior where you're acting on stereotype and fear as opposed to real knowledge. There's another answer to this. And it's, you know, I don't mean to be fractious, and I certainly don't mean to be rude, but at some point, white America has to recognize that part of its birthright is the history and culture of America. And what that means is Native American culture, African American culture, cultures from people who've come from all around the world, from Japan to China, India, all of those people that make up this American polity, the answer is to stop denying your birthright. Stop imagining, stop being so arrogant as to think that the birthright that you accept of whiteness is sufficient. If it were sufficient, wouldn't need to denigrate others, wouldn't need to do those things that happen to other people in the name of white supremacy. Understand that white supremacy cannot function without the notion of inferiority. And to abandon that notion does not make you one of the inferior. What it makes you is a person that realizes that it is a false equation. White supremacy has always been a myth. What actually is a truth is the will to violence to support the myth. That's the only truth. And once white America accepts that and can do so without blanching, without feeling as if it is a zero-sum game in our society, then we'll make some progress. But I suspect that most people in the dominant culture are happy to be in something called dominant, that the preservation of that means something to them. And that is the saddest part about this legacy, is that what we're dealing with Breonna Taylor and Trayvon has nothing to do with Black people, nothing at all, except that they have been the victims of something, that white America must come to understand that hegemonic masculinity that undergirds white supremacy has been around since the beginning of time. And if we don't understand where white supremacy comes from, you're not going to have any chance at all of extirpating it. And that Black people and brown people have been standing by for centuries to help white folk to understand and work through that. But frankly, most white people haven't really cared to do that. The systems in place benefit them, supports them, privileges their history, privileges their culture. Why would they change? The idea that there might be something better for all of us if they gave that up is anathema to the white supremacist. It's not that complicated. Simply look at your truth, look at your history, intellectually, honestly, and we'll be fine. You know, I went to the Virginia Military Institute when it was all male and predominantly white. And I was part of what at that time was one of the largest classes of Black men. It was only about 20 of us who went to VMI. It was a huge class. And it wasn't long after we went through that the first women came through. And I'm here to tell you, I was a TAC officer at the time at the Virginia Military Institute when women came through. I was in the room when the first women came through the rat line. I made sure that I was in the room when those young women went through. I was the advisor to what was then, what used to be called the Rat Disciplinary Committee. And when I reported back to my brother rats and to other alumni that those two young women, when they came through, they outperformed the young men who were in the room doing the push-ups and all of the other good stuff. They outperformed them. No one wanted to hear that. It's been almost 20 years now since that happened. And VMI is a much better institution because it admitted women. VMI never could have seen itself as being better with women. And there are still some people who drag their feet on that. But women made that a better institution. That analogy holds for white supremacy and the dominant culture, that having people of color, having people who don't benefit from hegemonic masculinity, lesbian, gay, queer, trans people, having those people speak and have a voice is actually of a benefit to all of us. We're going to be a better society when the dominant culture gives up its notion of dominance. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that. So for those of us who do get asked over and over again, well, what do I do now? What can I do? We can't become weary. We have to continue to answer that question as we have for centuries. Don't put your knee on my neck. Don't hold me down when I tell you I can't breathe. Be humane. Treat other people with dignity and respect. And if you can do that, the other things will take care of themselves. That's what white America needs to hear. Collectively, white America has for centuries been Chauvin, for centuries now. And only just now are they listening to that voice saying, I can't breathe. Please, you're killing me. The good news is not all of us die. Not all of us die. George Floyd, we lost him, but not all of us die.
That was Associate Professor of American Literary Studies and Faculty Senate President Finney Coleman. You can find this episode and all our episodes online at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick, and thanks for listening to University Showcase.